What are some of the unusual or rare mammals in the El Paso area, or also just in the Chihuahuan Desert?
There's been a beaver. I still don't think they've actually physically seen it with their own eyes. Yeah. Keeps building dams. There's a lot of cottonwoods and willows that are growing there that the beaver will chew down and build dams with. Building dams is what they do, which is a problem at Rio Bosque, where all the water is very carefully managed, and so they don't want to flood areas, which is what the dam does. They initially tried taking the dam apart, and then the beaver would just rebuild it at night. They came up with a plan B, which called the beaver deceiver, and it was basically a big section of corrugated pipe that they would run under, you know, along the bottom of the canal. And so it allowed water to flow through, but it didn't create like a spill sound or anything that would really attract the beaver's attention. That poor beaver is just like, man, this just dam isn't working. It's like, damn, this dam.
Welcome to the fourth episode of Desert Diaries. I'm your host, Daniel Carey Whalen, director of the Centennial Museum in Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. I'm here with Dr. Kevin Floyd, our botanical curator of the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens, here for another exciting episode of Desert Diaries. We're talking about life in the Chihuahuan Desert. Last episode, we talked about some of the birds in the desert. Today we're going to talk about some of the mammals, some of the four-legged, warm-blooded creatures that are in the Chihuahuan Desert, in the El Paso area, that people in this area might see, but also throughout the whole Chihuahuan Desert. So what are some of the mammals that we can find in our desert area, and what makes them unique?
Some of the mammals, I think, they're a little bit harder to see. A lot of our mammals are more nocturnal, and so, they avoid the heat. That's their way of surviving, so they're underground or in a, you know, under a bush or something during the hot sun. And so a lot of this stuff, I think people don't realize how many mammals we have in the area. Some of the ones that people see more commonly are the mule deer. That's certainly becoming something if you're up near the mountains.
Two last night in my neighborhood.
Yeah, we've even a couple years ago, I know there was a great picture of some on the lawn outside Cotton Memorial here at the KTEP studios.
Wow.
So they do come down pretty far, and you know, people can see them going into their yards, especially, you know, I think it's happened recently because we've been in this drought condition.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, the deer are going in, they're looking for food. And so if you have a yard that maybe has some irrigation and some nice lush foliage, right. That's the food that those deer are going to need.
Yeah. I would see them in like around certain trees in my neighbor's yards. I don't know if they're like acorns or what it is, but
yeah. Could be. I know they do eat acorns. They can eat, I mean, any of the desert, you know, herbivores, the plant eaters, they're pretty tough. They can eat a lot of these really, you know, difficult things to eat. Yeah. Some of the ones that always impress me are the javelina, the peccaries, because you'll see prickly pears with bites out of them, and not like the soft part. Like they go right through the top where all the spines and the little hairs called glochids, and they're taking big chunks of them. And of course those spines are there to keep that plant from being eaten, but I guess desperate times when you live in the desert, you got to get your water somewhere. Right. So they must have some pretty tough cheeks and tongues to be able to deal with that. And those are ones that people see. Sometimes people call them wild hogs. There are wild hogs in Texas that are, an invasive species that can cause a ton of damage. They're big, they're smart. They destroy habitat, yards, all sorts of things. But luckily, you know, knock on wood, they're not here yet. They are getting, you know, in central Texas, it's a big deal. So they might show up. But right now, if you see something that looks like a pig, it's more than likely going to be one of our peccaries, our javelina.
They
can be. They're really cool to see, and in some places, so one of the best places that I've seen them is in the Davis Mountain State Park, in the campground there, and they're pretty acclimated to people, so they'll just like wander through your campground, looking for food, or even just eating the acorns and stuff that are on the ground.
Yeah. I've seen them, a big herd down in, when I was camping in Big Bend National Park, they seem to be pretty acclimated to humans. Definitely took off once, people started coming around, but
And they can be. I mean, they can be aggressive. And yeah, I know there's stories of them, you know, killing chihuahuas and small dogs and things like that. So you definitely want to be careful around them. But like your experience, most of the time they're going to run off before, you know, they cause any real problem.
Just heard someone in the west side of El Paso saying that they saw them up in the mountains there. So
yeah.
I know they're in the Franklin Mountains as well.
So some of the other mammals that are pretty interesting to see, I think another one that people are very familiar with are the ground squirrels, mm-hmm. Especially if you go to Memorial Park or Escarate also. They're pretty big. They're a big, you know, gray squirrel that lives underground, makes a sort of funny chirping noise. And, you know, they're ground squirrels. They like to live in the ground. And I've heard stories of people, you know, if you have to garden anywhere near where they are, they can be pretty destructive because they're coming in and, you know, digging up your plants and, again, trying to get the food that they need. But most of the time, you know, if you're not actively gardening, they're just a nice, you know, addition to see while you're walking around.
I'm trying to think of some other mammals that we see, like you said, most of them are coming out at night. I think we're going to get to some of the predators later.
Yeah. Even just here on campus, if you walk around at night, you'll often see skunks and foxes.
Right.
So we've got striped skunks, and then it's the gray fox. And they do well. I mean, you'd be surprised. They're probably, you know, living underneath a building that people have walked past every day. And we find them in the garden primarily through their scat. So we see, lots of fox poop. And they seem to like to poop in the middle of things. So they don't poop off to the side. They poop right in the middle of the walkway.
In my neighborhood, they're always pooping on the water meter. Yeah, right in the middle. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I only know this because my dog loves the...
Yeah, it's got to be something territorial where, you know, they're definitely not hiding their presence.
Yeah, right. I know they're kind of a fan favorite around the UTEP campus because, when people do see fox, I've seen lots of pictures on social media, UTEP social media I'm assuming we have several fox families around campus.
Yeah. It was before I started in the garden, but we actually had a family of foxes. So in one of the gardens, and the puppies, the kids, tore the garden up pretty good where in the section they were playing around in. It's all bounced back, but I know that was a concern for Barb, our gardener at the time.
Well, that kind of leads me to, the human-animal relationship, right? And are any of these mammals threatened due to, suburban sprawl due to a development? And do any of these, we'll start with that, but then also do any of these animals pose a threat to humans or their pets?
We don't really know necessarily what's happening with the populations. Most of the mammals that are in this area that I'm aware of, their populations are doing okay. So when we get development, we're displacing them. So we see a decrease in that local population. But in general, the populations are doing pretty well. And you can see most of the mammals around. Like I said, deer populations seem to be doing okay. The rabbit populations, but we have both desert cottontail as well as the black-tailed jackrabbit. Those populations had decreased a couple years ago because there was a rabbit hemorrhagic fever. So it was virus, I think, that was in fact impacting them, and it had really high mortality rates. And so a lot of the populations really took a big hit from that. But certainly in the last year or two, we've been seeing a lot more. So it seems like the ones that did survive that disease are reproducing and repopulating, which is what happens in nature. Things new bacteria or viruses come through, and the susceptible ones get wiped out, and then the ones that are better that can handle those or are resistant to those pathogens can survive. So we just have to hope there's enough individuals out there that there are some of those resistant ones in the population when new diseases sweep through. So that was definitely a concern at the time, but it does seem like they've they bounce back. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
And then for things that are, you know, potentially harmful or cause problems with people, sort of the negative side, sometimes called nuisance animals. So, you know, we do have predators in the area. There's probably in the Franklin Mountains, there's probably a couple mountain lions. I know people, you know, the rangers are usually in further back country, so they're not sort of at this southern tip that's really surrounded by the city. They're further away from everybody, and there's some cool motion sensor cameras and things where they've seen sightings of mountain lions. But like I said, there's a couple of them, and most of the time you would never know even if you came close to them.
They're pretty nocturnal, pretty
want
to be left alone.
Yeah, and they certainly, I mean, could they kill a dog or a cat? Certainly, but most of the time it's not going to be an issue just because they don't want to deal with that. They want to be away from people. The other nuisance animals, I mean, if you're a gardener, deer are certainly a nuisance, and some of those rabbits and things like that. And there's not, I mean, with most of the nuisance, so things that people interact with more, it's stuff like skunks. Skunks will dig holes in your yard.
Yes,
they're looking for grubs. The deer eating plants in your yard, rabbits eating plants, things like that. Most of the time, the solution is basically we have to change. We have to do something differently. So, you know, these animals were here before we were. So, you know, we're living in their homes. And so what you can do is, you know, if you have skunks, they crawl under things. So look for those gaps in your wall and make sure that everything is really well sealed, and that, you know, those, they can still get in the front yard possibly. We just planted a new cactus in our yard in the front yard last week. Uh-huh. Anytime you plant something new, our neighborhood skunk is like, ooh, that seems interesting, and tries to dig it out. And so now when we plant stuff, we pile rocks around it, and that just keeps them from digging.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's
just
good,
like protect that. Right. And so, again, it's changing our behavior so that, you know, because otherwise, I mean, there's nothing we can really do long term. There's sprays and things that are supposed to keep pests out. And it's like coyote urine and things like that. And they might be somewhat effective, but, you know, they don't seem to be there's nothing I know of that people are like, yes, this is the product, works 100% of the time, you're golden.
Foolproof.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Well, and, you know, and talking about skunks, I think most people are, you know, their experience with them is the smell, right? And, you know, I have two dogs, and so one of them just got sprayed fairly recently, I think in the last couple of months, and it is a nuisance. I mean, it's just, I mean, the smell is god awful, and it took weeks to get out. You know, I think there's just so many skunks in our neighborhood, and they have chutzpah. I mean, they're not afraid of. We've had skunks, you know, move towards us as opposed to away from us when they see us, and I think, we have a dog. Like, what are they thinking? But I don't know. They don't seem to have any fear.
Yeah. I think they're probably assuming most animals are smart enough to know to leave them alone so they don't get sprayed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of dogs are just curious, or, you know, hopefully yours will learn from the bad experience. I've heard stories of people whose dogs don't learn and just get sprayed all the time. But some animals are just slow learners, I guess.
Definitely a nuisance in our house. And you just, I feel like there's just certain times of the year you walk around neighborhoods in El Paso or just driving around and you just smell the skunk smell.
But they're so cute. I think that's the thing that people, if you really see them, I mean, they've got that big fluffy tail.
Yeah,
they're kind of low to the ground and sort of waddle around.
They are cute.
Yeah. Just need to enjoy them from a distance where they don't feel so threatened that they try to spray you.
Right, yeah. When I always heard that they don't want to spray, you know, that they're, energy and then they can't, you know, I know biologically they can't spray again for a certain period of time or something.
Some quantity, and, you know, once they use it up, they have to regenerate it. And so I know they do the display, like they stamp their feet first and then they do like a headstand even and just things that are trying to warn people or warn animals before they actually unleash the stink.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, usually it's anytime the dogs have been sprayed, it's been taken by surprise.
Right.
You know, we didn't see it; it was in a bush, and the dog just jumped into a bush and then came out with the face. You know. They are cute. I mean, I know that we talk about in our families of being a pretty cute animal.
And then just one other thought on the nuisance things. A lot of the animals are going after garbage. And so a lot of it is also just making sure that all the garbage goes into the garbage can. If you're feeding, pets outside, if you leave that dog food out or that cat food out, that's food for the skunks and the foxes and the coyotes.
Right.
And so, again, that's on us to change our behavior. So, if you feed your animals outside, that's great, but then be sure to sort of move that inside overnight when, again, most of the animals are nocturnal. So, feed them during the day outside and then scoop it all up and make sure it's cleaned up. Otherwise, you're putting food out for them. And same with garbage cans. Don't let your garbage can get too full and have things blown around. I've seen foxes on campus eating, out of McDonald's bags. So, someone left a bag in the parking lot and that's... right. They were loving it. So, we don't have black bear in the area. There are black bear in the Chisos Basin and Big Bend and in the Davis Mountains, but
up in the Sacramentos.
Yeah, places that have bears, it's largely changing people's behavior. It's getting those bear-proof garbage cans. It's getting the things that, the bears can't get into. And it's this, same with our foxes and skunks and things like that. Just need to use things that we're not giving them extra resources, basically, because that's going to be what attracts them to your yard.
I'm thinking of other kind of, animals like that. Raccoons? Mm-hmm. Do we have a lot of raccoons?
We do. And I feel like we've been seeing more of them. I've been seeing more sightings and people hearing about them more. Yeah. And I don't know if that's that maybe their population has increased. Maybe it's the drought making them come into areas. Or if people are just paying more attention, which is also possible. Hard to say exactly what's going on. But I know we've had them here on campus. I know people – I've seen them at Rio Bosque. I think people up near the mountains have been reporting them as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, I think, I like that comment of, are we just seeing more of them? I know there's been a proliferation of cameras. I mean, I feel like that, that's a common thing in this digital age when everyone has a cell phone camera on them that we take pictures of things and feel like, is this happening more or are we just taking more pictures of them? But there's also a proliferation of the wildlife cameras.
Yeah.
I know, Lois Balin, who's with the county.
Texas Parks and Wildlife.
Yeah,
she's the urban biologist.
That's right.
Here. Yeah.
That she's wanting that there's a project to put cameras in the garden, but other places around town. But what's up with those cameras?
Yeah, so they've been around for a while. I think that as the optics get better and the technology gets better and they become a lot cheaper, people are using them more, and they're usually motion activated, so they have some sort of infrared or something like that. And when something walks in front of it, it shoots the picture, and then you can go back and download them. That's the easy way to do it. There's the fancy ones that actually have like Wi-Fi connection if you're near a city or cell coverage or something like that. And then you can just, sit in your office and have a cup of coffee and log in and see what wandered by your camera. But it is like so many of these things are so hard to see because they're active at night, because they don't like people. And so by putting up all of these cameras, we're able to see things. First of all, just more sets of eyes, basically more sets of lenses, but also at a time of day that most people don't really want to be out looking for them. And initially, like some of the first ones, it looked like the Bigfoot photos, right? They were just these blurry, it's like, oh, yeah, sure, that's a skunk. Or is it a person? But they've gotten really good now. So there's some really impressive photos, and some do video, and just can be really, really great quality.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was just thinking, we don't have one in our house, but there's the doorbell camera. I feel like Lots of deer sightings because of doorbell cameras, right? Yeah. There's just kind of, like you said, more lenses out there. Yeah. From a scientific point of view, what's the advantage of those cameras and having all those kind of eyes on the ground?
Yeah, so it's really trying to document where things are. So what's there? Yeah. How many of them are there? And, you know, potentially what are they doing? So, you know, when you're seeing, you know, deer in different parts of town, it's like, oh, I didn't know that they made it that far down, you know, from the mountain, but here's a sighting of one. Or maybe you can find, like, near some of the arroyos that haven't been developed. Like, those are corridors that have been used by, you know, wildlife for centuries, millennia, to go from, like, the mountains down to the river and back. And so, you know, people that live near those areas might be seeing more of those sightings because of that. And so we can see what are the corridors that are important to protect for wildlife, what are the things that are important to preserve for that.
Well, you know, we talked about the mountain lions. I know there's a lot of other predators out here. You know, what are some of the other, I'm thinking that the cats are definitely predators. We kind of talked about them, you know, eating birds the other day. Are dogs, are like coyotes? We have coyotes here. Are they predators or kind of scavenger predator?
So they're in sort of both, probably, right? So they will scavenge things. Like, a lot of the coyote poop that we see has mesquite seeds in it. And so they're eating mesquite pods, and they'll eat, you know, rose hips and other fruits and things like that. But they also can catch rats and rodents, and they'll eat lizards and, you know, a lot of the smaller stuff that are out there. So they're definitely predators. Typically, like, food, you know, the size of the predator impacts the size of the food. So, you know, like, coyotes might eat a rabbit, a fox might eat a ground squirrel, ring-tailed cats, which are another cool mammal that, like, we almost never see because they're nocturnal, really nocturnal and up in the mountains, might be eating, you know, centipedes or things like that that are smaller still, or lizards. And then, you know, mountain lions will eat they'll eat deer. That's one of the primary food sources for them.
So
yeah, so they're looking bigger, but they'll also, you know, eat a rabbit or something like that.
And bobcats? We have bobcats here.
We do. Yeah, I've seen some out at Rio Bosque. I'm sure they're in the mountains as well. Those are, again, mostly eating rodents, probably birds, lizards, things like that.
Yeah. What about, I have a friend who lives, like, right up against Crazy Cat Mountain. Their backyard faces there, and their dog disappeared.
What size dog?
A smaller dog. A Shih Tzu or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, it could have been coyote. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they're able to jump into a yard and take something out. Smaller dogs could also be prey for things like great horned owls that we have. If they're out at night, that can be an issue. You know, definitely a recommendation is don't let little dogs out at night if you're not there, especially if you live someplace that's close to some natural areas, because there's predators out there, and that dog is essentially a rabbit. Right. So, you know, it's a good prey for some of these other carnivores.
Well, you know, one of the biggest carnivores in this area is the Mexican gray wolf. I know that there's people in the area who are advocating for the return of the Mexican gray wolf to the Chihuahuan Desert. Why are they advocating that? And what would some of the benefits be to a reintroduction of a keystone species like the Mexican gray wolf?
Yeah, so the Mexican gray wolf, it's an interesting conservation story. They were a lot of predators in the 1800s, early 1900s, some even up through today, were hunted. There were paid government programs to hunt these predators because people didn't want them eating sheep and cattle. That was the main thing. They were protecting livestock industry. And so the the Mexican gray wolf was down to, I think, somewhere around 10 individuals.
Wow.
And there were some in Mexico still. There are southwestern wolf species or subspecies.
Right.
And they were all rounded up and taken into captivity, and they did captive breeding programs.
Yeah.
And then from those, and those are kind of scattered around. The zoo actually has, I think, seven of them right now. There's a pack of five males and then a male and female that are kept separately. And so there's these wolves in this breeding program sort of scattered around. And then as they start getting big enough numbers, they'll reintroduce them into the wild.
Yeah.
Around here, that's the Gila Wilderness, the Gila Mountains.
Right.
And so there's been a program for probably 20-ish years of releasing wolves into the wild.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, you know, they have collars on, GPS collars, so the scientists know where they are. They know how many packs there are. They're right now being pretty tightly controlled to just the Gila area.
I thought they were also down in the Boot Hill, down the Animas Mountains.
I don't know. There might be some wild ones there.
Okay,
I think most of
that came up from Mexico.
Possibly, yeah. There's even a story. There was one that was tracked that came through El Paso. Like, it was one that had a collar, and it came up. This was, I forget when, within the last 5 or 6 years probably, they saw its track, and it went sort of from the Juarez Mountains up near the – is that Anthony? What's the town in New Mexico, port of entry?
Santa Teresa.
Santa Teresa, yes, thank
okay.
you. So it went sort of in that area and like went possibly, I think, through like Cristo Rey and sort of those mountains and went across the border and came into the U.S. for a couple days and then turned around and went back. And
and
I may not, you know, the dates and stuff may not be correct, but they had, you know, radio collar of it or GPS collar and actually tracked it coming through.
Yeah.
And I think that was from a population in Mexico. The population that's in New Mexico and Arizona, if an individual leaves the wilderness area, they actually will have to trap it and bring it back to that area because they're not allowed to take it out of that. That was part of the agreement of the reintroduction.
Right.
And so now there's a group that's interested in trying to get basically the Big Bend area, the Chisos Mountains, as a new release site. It's a nice wilderness area. So, you know, there's
lots of wilderness down there.
Lots of space. And, you know, who knows how successful it'll be? It is Texas, so, you know, not the most wildlife-friendly state. But if we can get something done, it's a great way to, you know, spread. It's the eggs in one basket, right? So right now, all of the Mexican wolves are in, like, two baskets. There's one in the U.S., one in the Gila area, and one in Mexico. And so if we can spread those out a little bit, then we, you know, decrease the chance of something happening, you know, poorly due to chance. There's fires in the Gila. I mean, there's things that could happen to those individuals. But also one of the cool things is that because wolves are predators, they can have a big impact on the ecosystem.
Yes, right.
And
exactly.
So,
what are some of those?
Yeah,
impacts?
So they'll eat both some of the smaller carnivores, so they can eat things like foxes and so on, but they also eat a lot of the herbivores. And so the Mexican wolf will eat deer potentially and some of the smaller herbivores that are really can cause problems in terms of overgrazing.
Right.
So because we've taken all these predators out of the system, all of their prey have increased.
Yeah.
The best example of this is if anyone's been basically anywhere east of us with white-tailed deer. White-tailed deer are causing a ton of problem in the East Coast,
amazing.
And it's because we've killed other predators, and even as
out of
much
control.
And as much hunting by people as happens, it's just not enough to replace, you know, the predators and you know, deer.
I'm just reading that they're hiring sharpshooters in like Pennsylvania to like go out and just kill deer.
There's just too many of them, and they're default. You know, you can go into a forest and there's like nothing growing like 8 feet and down because that's, you can see how high the deer can get, and they just graze that out completely. And so when you reintroduce the predators, when you reintroduce those wolves, you start to restore some of that balance to the food chain. So you decrease some of the herbivores, which then means the plants can grow better and bring back some of the other pieces. So that can allow, you know, if the plants are growing, that provides food for the insects like we talked about before, and then food for the birds and some of these other pieces that aren't directly connected to, you know, wolf eats deer eats grass, but all the other stuff that's sort of indirectly connected there can have a really big benefit.
Yeah, no, there's an amazing little, you know, if you look on YouTube, a little 8-minute video or something about the reintroduction of the wolf into Yellowstone and how it literally changed the course of rivers, right? Like that it all the things you're talking about. And so ultimately the rivers changed because they had freer flow, they had more of the infrastructure, all the plants that were on the side that weren't being eaten by the deer,
right? And stuff.
Yeah,
that's a great video. I used to, when I was teaching here, I would show that video whenever we talked about sort of food webs and conservation.
Right. Really fascinating. And they're so it's such a rich topic. I mean, just when you were talking about that wolf coming up from Mexico and then going back, and Cormac McCarthy's famous author from this area, wrote the Border Trilogy, and the second book's called The Crossing, and it's about a young man who takes this wolf from that area, the Animas area down in the Boot Hill, back into Mexico. But just that idea of the crossing back and forth, just like humans have been crossing this border, it wasn't even a border for so long. Animals are always crossing it, and it just, I briefly just wanted to talk about there is a movement amongst environmentalists that are concerned about, the border wall and animals. Can you just give us a little talk about that, or what you know about that?
Yeah, so there have been a few studies, but you basically put a 20-foot fence in the middle of otherwise continuous habitat, and it's disrupting the ability of animals to move. So the wolf is an example. Yeah. Some places it's pronghorn antelope that migrate back and forth. There's birds that fly, and you would think, oh, birds can just fly over it. But I think it's a species of owl tends to fly really close to the ground. Uh-huh. And so there's concern about them actually, will they come to the wall and fly up and over, or will they turn around and go back where they came from? So there is a lot of concern where you're taking these populations that used to totally go back and forth and be able to reproduce together, and we're isolating them. And the smaller the population, the more likely it is to have inbreeding and genetic problems. And so, the more fragmented we make things, the harder it is for that wildlife to survive. And then the other part with it is a lot of times there's a ton of lighting. So if you've, driven along the border at night, it's really lit up, which makes sense from a security point of view, but that's going to keep a lot of those animals from even approaching it. So it's a concern. I don't know. It's that tough balance, right? People are concerned about security of the border, but then we're also concerned about wildlife and making sure that the wildlife can survive. And so there's a lot of very difficult situations where there's no clear answer. And I think that's certainly one of them.
Yeah. Just that. It sounds like the Mexican gray wolf was able to cross the border, which is pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and it was probably the time that the fence was a little bit different, and it was more like a vehicle barrier that still allowed for wildlife to cross underneath. And a lot of that's been replaced with the same, type of wall that we have here in El Paso. That's the bollards, the really tall metal posts that are just a couple inches apart from each other. Yeah. And so, wolves are not going to be able to make it through those.
Right. Well, just to switch gears, what are some of the unusual or rare mammals in the El Paso area, or also just in the Chihuahuan Desert? And the one that immediately comes to mind, I know, is there's a beaver down at the Rio Bosque.
That was the first one that came to my mind too.
Yeah.
So it's been there for, and it's the thing, like we talked about with ducks in El Paso, there's no water. Beaver in El Paso. But we do have water in some areas. And there's been a beaver, again, on those trail cams like we talked about. I still don't think they've actually physically seen it with their own eyes, they've been lots of recorded photos of it, even as recently as earlier this week.
And evidence, right?
They can see there's dams. They keep building. It keeps building dams. And so there's been a beaver, whether it's the same one or not, at Rio Bosque for probably 5 or 6 years. And it's a sign of, the restoration of the park, that there's food for them now. There's a lot of cottonwoods and willows that are growing there that the beaver will chew down and build dams with. And it's just they building dams is what they do, right. Which is a problem at Rio Bosque, where all the water is very carefully managed. And so they don't want to flood areas, which is what the dam does. And so they initially tried taking the dam apart, and then the beaver would just rebuild it at night. It's another nocturnal thing, right? So you go take the dam apart, and then it rebuilds it, and then you take it apart and rebuild it. And so they came up with a plan B, which John Sproul, who just retired recently, but he was the manager out there, called the Beaver Deceiver. And it was basically a big section of corrugated pipe that they would run under, you know, along the bottom of the canal from one side of the dam to the other. And so it allowed water to flow through, but it didn't create like a spill sound or anything that would really attract the beaver's attention. And so that poor beaver is just like, man, this just dam isn't working. It's like, damn, this dam.
Bad dam building.
I know. So it has like five or six of them. I guess it just keeps trying, and then they keep putting a beaver deceiver in, and they're working towards a coexistence with the wildlife that's there. And I think people have seen them in the upper valley as well, along the river and in some of the canals there. But there's also muskrat. And so you always have to wonder, you know, if you see something, a mammal swimming in the water, is it a beaver or is it a muskrat? Muskrats are way more common.
I just heard, I forgot what the Spanish name for muskrat was, but I was like, what is that species? Muskrat.
So those are probably some of the more unusual ones. There have been... So bats, which we haven't talked about much. Bats are also mammals. There's most of the bats that we have in the area are insectivorous. So it means they eat insects. So you'll see them at night sort of flitting around.
I see them in my neighborhood thinking, you know, one less mosquito I have to worry about.
I know, right? Like we should all, you know, thank a bat, right? If you don't like mosquito bites and disease, then you should love bats. But there's a couple species that are nectar-feeding bats, and we're not sure if they're in the area. There's not good documentation of them. They're in the Big Bend area, and they're in the Sonoran Desert around Tucson, and I think there's a population in the Boot Heel of New Mexico, and so there's questions about, you know, are they coming sort of along the river and through El Paso into that section, or are they just coming up from Mexico and sort of splitting around the Sierra Madres? But they're listed, because there's so few of them in Texas, it is a Texas threatened species. And so we're actually, you know, because they're nectar feeding, they love agaves. That's one of the main things. And we're trying to work with Bat Conservation International to grow agaves. And they're trying to really, you know, repopulate agaves in what they're calling like this nectar corridor, nectar highway, so that, you know, as the bats are moving around and maybe even shifting ranges as climate changes, that there will be, you know, nice agaves waiting for them when they show up. Agaves take a long time to grow and get to where they flower. So we're starting now to have things that will be flowering in, you know, 10, 15 years.
Right. I love it. It's a big project that, you know, we're, of course, the Chihuahuan Desert Gardens is involved with, the El Paso Zoo is as well. And it's a whole kind of citizen science thing too, right? People are growing agave, and then they're going to bring it back in a year or two, and when they're larger, and so they can be part of the program.
Yeah, the zoo was running that last year. I think they did 2 years, and so you basically, you know, adopt agave, you foster an agave. And part of it is just it's so much work that, you know, with small organizations, and Bat Conservation is pretty big, but they're trying to grow a bunch of agaves, and so that way, you know, we can all help out. Agaves are pretty easy to keep alive, so everybody takes one, takes care of it for a year or two, gets it to a larger size, and then brings it back, and then they, you know, gather them up and then go plant them out in the wild, whether that's, you know, maybe a rancher, private property that cares about conservation and wants to increase their habitat for them, or a park or something like that.
What a great program. What are some ways that we can, I mean, we've kind of been talking about this, but that we can ensure the area's mammals and humans live in harmony?
Yeah, so I think, you know, a lot of it is, you know, we need to be careful how we develop. We need to leave habitat for these animals. We need to be able to protect some of those corridors like the arroyos and some of the other areas so that there's just places for them to live. But then it's really, I think, to the conversation about nuisance animals. How do we make sure that we're not creating conflicts with these animals? So making sure that we all know what to do and that we can educate as many people as possible that, you know, keep your garbage put away, don't leave out dog food, all these things we talked about. And then the wildlife can be wild and we can be happy and not sprayed by skunks or be worried about seeing foxes around or things like that. And then I think just more education, right? Like, we don't need to be scared of these things. I see a lot of times it's like, I saw a coyote, everybody like grab your kids and take them inside. And and I mean, again, there have been cases of coyotes attacking kids, but it's very rare. And so, you know, you want to be careful, you want to be aware, but you don't have to, you know, you more than likely don't need to run and hide if you see a coyote. Like, you can watch it and see how cool they are. And if you're lucky, maybe you hear them howl at night if you're, you know, again, near where they live, and have that connection to the wild that, you know, we lack so much in living in cities.
All good pointers to remind us to live with the animals that are surrounding us. I think, Kevin, as always, this has been a great conversation, and we're going to wrap up the fourth episode of Desert Diaries. My name is Daniel Carey Whalen. I'm the director of the Centennial Museum and Chihuahuan Desert Gardens. We look forward to everyone joining us to celebrate life in the Chihuahuan Desert. We'll see you next time on Desert Diaries.
Desert Diaries is recorded in the KTEP Public Media Studios and is a production of the University of Texas at El Paso Division of Marketing and Communications. Host is Daniel Carey Whalen, producer is Charles Fench, engineering by Paul Castro.
I saw a coyote, everybody like grab your kids and take them inside. And and I mean, again, there have been cases of coyotes attacking kids, but it's very rare.